The following program is brought to you by Hanson McLean Advisors, and the views expressed may not necessarily reflect the views of this station.
Hi, this is Scott.
This is Pat. Today we're going to talk about what you should expect out of your financial advisor.
That's right. We're going to have that. We're also going to be taking a number of calls. I know it's summer's kind of coming down to an end. Some kids are heading back to school, but we've got a great program lined up with many calls and what you should really look out for your financial advisor.
Yeah, what your advisor should be doing for you.
Yeah, so stick around for Hanson McLean's Money Matters.
Wondering if you're on track with your financial matters? Call now at 1-888-2-HANSON. That's 1-888-2-HANSON.
Welcome to Hanson McLean's Money Matters. I'm Scott Hanson.
I'm Pat McLean. Thanks for joining us.
That's right. We're glad you are here with us today as we talk about the world of finance and investment and all that stuff. Both myself and my co-host, we are both financial advisor, certified financial planner, chartered financial consultant. We meet with people like yourself each day during the week and come to the studios to be your financial advisors on the weekends. And if you'd like to join us with one of your questions you may have for us, it might be you're considering something yourself in your financial life and trying to figure out the right thing to do. Maybe someone's pitching you some product and you're wondering, I don't know, should I really be buying this or not? Maybe just like a second opinion on a strategy that you're employing currently. Whatever the case, if you'd like to join our program, to call us, you call 1-888-2-HANSON. That's 1-888-2-HANSON, 1-888-2-HANSON. Numerically, it's 1-888-242-6766.
If you're looking for an advisor, let's give someone a couple things to think about, Scott. If you had to name three things that you should actually pay attention to, the first thing I would do is
Google broker check. Just remember the phrase broker check. Google broker check. It'll take you to a site where you can put the person's name in. It'll give you a background information on that advisor. Broker check.
So the second,
just Google broker check.
The second
check. Right there, you'll find out what their education is. Have they been fined or barred?
So the second thing you want to look at or think about or pay close attention to when you're meeting, interviewing advisors is, are they offering product solutions right off the bat? So are they suggesting a big fat annuity before they even understand your problems? Are they suggesting a cash value life insurance policy? Are they suggesting some long-term care or some structured product such as a limited partnership? Sometimes a good financial advisor will tell you to do nothing. Sometimes the best thing for you to do is nothing. The third thing you want to pay attention to if you're interviewing an advisor is that if they push you to make decisions quickly, if they say you need to do this now or time's running out or the rules have changed or the rules are changing or you need to do this immediately, run away. Just run away. So those are the three things that you need to look at when you're interviewing financial advisors. Background check. Go to brokercheck.com. Are they offering product solutions? And do they push you to make decisions quickly? Because it's a big decision to choose a financial advisor.
Looking for if you want a financial advisor, I would assume you would like somebody that you could work with long term, right? So that's something that we would recommend. And we're going to go to the phones right off the bat. We're talking with Bernice in Georgia. Bernice, you're with Hanson McLean.
Yes. My name is Bernice, and will be 69 in February.
Okay.
I retired in 2014. And in another year, I would need to take a distribution from my IRA.
Mm-hmm.
I have some savings, and I have a Roth IRA, and I have a traditional IRA.
And how much do you have in your traditional IRA?
About $500,000.
And are you taking any income from that today to help supplement your...
No, I don't need to. I have Social Security and I have a pension, and I haven't taken any from any of my investments.
Okay,
because I don't need to.
Well, let's ask a couple questions to see if you're a candidate now for a conversion from an IRA to a Roth IRA.
For just some portion, so before you get started.
Yeah. So what's your approximate income for between the pension and the Social Security?
About $50,000 a year.
And are you married?
No.
And any dependents?
No.
Yeah, I don't think it makes sense. She's not only that, she's got a required minimum distribution.
Yeah.
Beginning next year.
My question was, what would be the best? Do I start taking some now, or just wait until it's time to
take out? It's really, the challenge is it's not going to make any difference. I mean, unless we see some major overhaul in the tax code in 2017, which mm-hmm. I suppose is possible. You're at a point now where,
You know, Scott, I'm gonna disagree with you. How much money do you have in your regular Roth?
I have $100,000 in my regular Roth.
And wow. How much do you have in savings?
You've converted a lot.
I have about $200,000 in savings.
And do you owe anyone money?
I still have a mortgage on my home.
How big?
$14,000.
You owe $14,000 on the mortgage.
Yes.
Why haven't you paid that off?
Because of the tax, I still itemize my taxes, and that helps me with my itemization.
And you give some money to charity that helps you with the itemization as well.
Yes, I do. I give quite a bit to charity.
Yeah, I knew that. Just from figuring out why you were itemizing.
Why you were itemizing, yeah.
What's the interest rate on that mortgage?
5%.
This doesn't make any difference if she pays it off, does it?
Yeah, well, let's stop for a minute. You know what? How much do you give to charity every year, approximately?
Approximately $6,000.
So we should actually, when the RMD kicks in, you should actually have those dollars go to the charity, the $6,000.
Yes.
Okay.
And then start a monthly distribution.
So to Pat's point, you can have money go directly from the required minimum distribution. You can have it go directly from the IRA to your charity.
Okay.
And it lowers the taxable income.
Yes.
And I'd pay that house off tomorrow.
So paying off the $14,000.
Yeah. You have some money. How much money do you have in the bank, like in a savings account, like down at the local bank?
Oh, about $7,000 that I keep for house maintenance.
She has a couple hundred thousand. It doesn't make any difference whether you pay it off, Pat.
Yeah, It doesn't matter. Here's what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to start spending some of this money. That's what I'd like you to do. If you were my mother, or you'd be too young to be my mother. If you were my sister.
That's when you know you've been doing this a long time.
I know, when you can't use that anymore. If you were my sister, I would say, hey, Bernice, what are you doing? Enjoy this. You've worked your whole life for it. You're going to have to change your behavior a little bit. Go buy your...
I travel.
Okay. So, no, you know what, though? Here's another way to look at it. So you give $6,000 a year to charity, which is quite a bit, more than 10% of your income. You've got a lot of assets. You could say the required minimum distribution is going to be at about 3.5%. It's going to kick in next year.
Yeah, so you're going to have
one
to
thing
think
you
in
could,
about 17, 18,000.
One thing you could say is, you know, you don't have to do this every year, but you could say, maybe I'll see if there's some charities that I can really get involved in and have these go to one or two or three charities, whatever it is, and... take the required minimum distributions and just use them for those charitable purposes.
She could do that, or a combination of the two.
Yeah, or a combination of the two.
So if you were sitting in my office, I'd say, Bernice, why don't we start a monthly income of $1,000 a month when this required minimum distribution, and all the rest of it will go to charity.
Okay.
And that way, it's good for your taxes. It's going to lower your taxable event, what you're going to pay in taxes because of the RMD is going directly to the charity. And then spend the rest. Just spend it. Go out to dinner more or travel more or buy.
Well, you don't have to spend it if she doesn't want to spend it.
No, correct.
I do have, I don't have children of my own, but I do have a lot of nieces and nephews, and some of them are in school. And I am helping them, the ones
that's
that
wonderful.
Are in school.
Yeah.
So, my main thing was what would be the best way. When I do have to take an R&D, what would be the best way to do it?
Having some go directly to charity, it bypasses the tax return entirely, doesn't become a taxable event.
But it lowers the amount that you're going to have to pay taxes on.
What you could, if the simplest thing is we would say, Bernice, what you do is you just take the required minimum distribution, have it set up each year. It gets transferred from your IRA to your other account. Let's assume you have some brokerage account or an account tied to that. And then the tax, you have tax withheld, it gets sent to the tax man and just have it set from one account to the next. That's the simplest way.
But because you're actually funding these charities now, you'd say, I'm going to give $6,000. What'd you say? You give approximately $6,000 a year to charities. I got $6,000 actually going to the charities, and I got another $1,000 a month coming to me. And I'm going to withhold 25% taxes on it, some state, some federal, and I'm going to call it a day. And then I'm going to spend it. When it gets to my house, I'm going to spend it.
Okay.
Or help your nieces or nephews.
Yeah, nieces or nephew. You'll be the best aunt in the world.
But it should go directly to the charity, not when
that
I take it out.
Correct.
Go straight to the charity and not come to me.
Correct. And the IRA custodian or your financial advisor.
And her tax, it may not make any difference. Whether it flows through the top line and then comes out as an itemized deduction or not. Because she doesn't have to deal with any personal exemptions getting reduced, doesn't have any itemized exemption reductions. You're looking at me like, I think you're right, aren't you, Pat?
No, I'm thinking, yeah, that's true, but it might be easier to have it come from the IRA to the charity.
Just to get discipline.
It's just easier.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Bernice. You know, I got to tell you, she was just as sweet as can be.
She is?
Yeah. But I just think the world would be nice to have more people like Bernice.
Yeah, and generous.
Extremely generous.
Yeah. Generous. So.
Again, to join Hanson McLean, 1-888-2-HANSON. That's 1-888-2-HANSON. And we're going to talk with David in Southern California. David, you're with Hanson McLean.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, David.
Here's the kind of the situation that I've got. My dad is not currently on Medi-Cal and is not in a skilled nursing facility. However, he's receiving in-home care 24/7 at his own expense because of medical issues. He's currently 78 years old. He has a living trust, and his home is in the trust. He has about 2 years' worth of money to pay for his in-home care. After that, he would need to apply for Medi-Cal and go into a skilled nursing facility.
Mm-hmm.
According to a website called California Advocates for Nursing Home Care, Medi-Cal recovery has been severely restricted for those who die on or after January 1st, 2017. This is thanks to Senate Bills 33 and 833. The new recovery bill limits recovery to only those assets subject to California probate. Because my dad's house is in a living trust with me as the beneficiary and successor trustee, his home would no longer be subject to recovery by Medi-Cal. According to this website, property transferred prior to death and no longer in the beneficiary's name is also exempt from estate recovery.
Yeah.
However, if he were to transfer the home to me now, I would expect that I would have to pay capital gains tax, whereas if I wait to receive the home until after his death and through the trust, I would not have to pay capital gains tax. Now, here's my question.
Mm-hmm.
Does all of this sound right?
No.
And should I reasonably expect to receive my dad's house as an inheritance should my dad eventually file for Medi-Cal benefits at a later date?
Yeah. What's the value? So let's just start with this premise. And I got to I went through this recently with a family member, this whole exercise. What's the value of the home?
Approximately $600,000. It might be a little bit more than that, but around that.
Okay.
Value.
And I'm going to ask a question that may be hard to answer, but let's try to remove ourselves emotionally from the situation, recognizing he is your father. What do you think his life is he married?
My mother passed away in 2000.
Okay. What do you think his life expectancy is?
Well, the thing is, what he's got right now is the medical condition that he has is not terminal.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what he has is he's not able to use his hands, mm-hmm. and he really cannot use the bathroom on his own.
Got it.
So the thing is, it could be that he could potentially live, you know, past the 2 years that he has the funds for the 24/7 care at home, and he could be in skilled nursing facility, you know, for a while.
So and so you're talking about Medicaid benefits. What? How much cash does he have? You said 2 years. What's that dollar amount?
I believe he has about $200,000 in CDs right now that he's using for his in-home care.
Okay. So here's one of the – everything you read to me sounds highly suspect, number one. If you did not inherit this money, would you be okay financially, you personally?
Well, it's not going to hurt me financially to not inherit the home, but obviously I would like to, you know, and I would not like it to be where I get the money instead of the state of California gets the money.
So here's what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to call and see if you could find a Medicaid bed anywhere around where you live, because he can qualify for that benefit. That's the easy part. Finding a long-term care facility that will actually accept that payment is another thing entirely. That's number one. Number two, when you find one that will take them, go and visit it. It's not the same thing as a private pay
location or a board and care. They are completely different situations.
I think, Pat, your point is, let's assuming we can shelter the house.
Let's assume it.
So you're saying, let's assume we can shelter the house. Then the question is, what would then happen to Dad?
That is correct.
And your
I do have some experience already because my dad was in a skilled nursing facility for a short period of time. Because what the deal is he's not exactly straight on Medicare. He has Kaiser, which means that his benefits from Medicare have actually been given to Kaiser.
You're talking the difference between Medicare and Medicaid, right? Medi-Cal, Medicaid. So in Medi-Cal,
that's true.
Right? The reimbursement to the facility under Medicare is not the same. That comes from Social Security. It is not the same as the reimbursement that comes from the state of California. So my point being is that, assuming it's true, which I don't believe that website.
Well, let's putting something in a revocable living trust. That's if the trust is revocable, that means that the individual has the right to pull those assets back into their name.
And even if you put it in an irrevocable trust, the state of California has a look back in order to pull that back out. What you said about the capital gains is absolutely correct, but that's a tax issue. That
Unless
is nothing.
But he still lives in the home, correct?
Correct.
Yes, he does.
Well, you could.
Depends what the price was, what it was worth on year 2000 when mom
died.
Passed away, and if there's been more than $250,000 of gains.
So back to my point. You can do the research on sheltering that asset, but at the end of the day.
If you end up artificially impoverishing your father, which is really what you're talking about doing, right? Taking his asset.
I guess that's kind of the bottom line.
That's what it is. It's called a spend down.
So if in fact you are able to shelter those assets so that your father goes on Medicaid or Medi-Cal for California, what Pat's point is the care he's going to receive from that is not.
It's not the same as what you saw when the facility was taking a Medicare reimbursement. If you can find it at all.
Well, then what happens when he gets to that point where he doesn't
you've
have
got,
money
You've
anymore?
Got so much runway. You've got $800,000 of runway in front of you. You have $800,000 of runway in front of you. And he has income right now. He has some Social Security income, I'm sure.
And a very tiny pension as well.
So you combine those two, and you've got probably 10 to 12 years of runway in front of you. So I wouldn't worry about it, David. I wouldn't spend another moment. You can go and visit these attorneys that will talk about artificially impoverishing your father in order to qualify for state aid. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I've seen both. But at the end of the day, the idea of doing that is to get state aid. You have to then find an organization, a facility that will take that reimbursement. And then you need to be comfortable with the fact that you would let your father stay there when you know.
Even in the place that he was at, I wasn't. It was probably like you're saying, a better place than what he would get. And I wasn't even happy with that.
Oh, my heart goes out. I personally have dealt with this myself over the last couple of years. It's not easy. But the reality is, it's your father's money, and it could be used to care for him in the highest and best standard possible. So you've got lots of runway. So
now, when he gets to the point where he doesn't have any cash left and he's down to his house, if I wanted him to be in a better facility than what Medi-Cal would pay for, would he just go into a facility where we would then have to attach the house
No, you would just sell the house and put the money in the bank and use the proceeds from that. He's not moving back to the house.
Oh, that's true.
He's not moving. And if you run out of money and he wants to stay at home and has the ability to stay at home, then you get a reverse mortgage on the house in order to have him stay at home. And you want to keep him at home as long as you possibly can.
Well, yes, because I saw him in the skilled nursing facility, and I've seen him at home.
Oh.
And he is, it's like the difference between night and day far as how he feels about everything.
So his emotion, his health, every part of it.
Here's what the plan should be then, Pat, based upon this. Is use the money he's got in those CDs as long as you can. When it starts getting really low, go get a reverse mortgage on the house.
Get a reverse mortgage on the house.
With the reverse mortgage, let's just say that he got the reverse mortgage and he only went 2 months into the reverse mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
The bank gets everything.
No. It's like a regular mortgage on your house.
Think of it like a line of credit that you don't have to make payments on.
That's all it is. So what happens is if they send him $4,000, then you owe the bank $4,000.
The rest of the equity.
And the rest of the equity is yours, minus some closing costs associated with getting the mortgage.
And are they all set up that way, or do they have to be?
Basically, there's two flavors. Most of them are FHA loans. There's a variable rate one. There's a fixed rate one. And there's some jumbo ones, but your father doesn't need to worry about. So he has a choice of vanilla or chocolate. That's it.
Yeah.
And they're all U.S. government backed loan.
So that should probably be.
Well, then that would actually make him feel better, because I think he's gotten it into his head, which I have too, that when this money runs out, that he's going to have to go into a skilled nursing facility,
David,
whereas that's not necessarily the case.
David, you have so little. I hate to say this out loud because I don't want to sound insensitive, but that's my nature. I'm a little insensitive. You don't have much to worry about. You have $800,000 in assets, a 78-year-old man that you love dearly. Keep him at home as long as you can. Don't worry about how the assets are actually settled right now, because you can turn any one of those assets into cash, either through a reverse mortgage or the sale of the property. And tell him not to worry. Say, Dad, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it, Dad.
Thank you so much for your help. I appreciate it.
Yeah, glad you called, David. And you know, Pat, it gets really complicated, doesn't it?
Oh, there's family members.
The call started with it's trying to. I thought all he really wanted to do is make sure that Dad's taken care of.
I'll tell you stories. One friend of mine called me and he says, "Hey, Pat, I'm going to get a reverse mortgage for my in-laws. What do you think?" And I said, "Don't you have a bunch of money?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "You're not going to get a reverse mortgage. You're going to be the reverse mortgage company. You're going to put together a document. You're going to send your in-laws a check every month, and that will accrue interest. And when they die, you'll get paid back from the sale of the property." So why would I do that? One is that the interest rate's pretty good. You're going to charge 4%, which is less. At the time, it was less than what the mortgage company would charge. And the second is you're going to avoid all those costs, and no problem. None.
Were there other siblings?
There were four other siblings, but it's a loan on the house.
I understand, but you know, here's the reality of it, right? Something about my own situation. I've got three sisters and two stepsisters and a stepbrother.
This is a Brady Bunch.
You know, for a while, there were six of us under the roof. It felt like, except the happiness.
Right?
I'm joking.
Marcia.
Didn't quite have that. No, I'm joking. But, and everyone's in different places economically.
That's correct. Right? Most families.
So I think about this personally, because one of the things as advisors, I always try to, all right, if I was in this situation or my loved one was in this situation. So then I think at the time, let's assume that this friend does this, at the time of death, oh, by the way, I get $112,000 from the estate before everybody else, and the rest of the siblings looking like, that guy's got all kinds of cash.
So that is right. That is right, Scott. But all the siblings, I warned the person. I said, look, before you do this, you need to let every one of the people that is a beneficiary of the estate know how this works. And they have a choice. You can lend it, or they can get a reverse mortgage. But it's less expensive if you lend it than if you get a reverse mortgage.
Well, I know mechanics all work. It just gets complicated.
It
and
does.
So many of people that we're dealing with here at Hanson McLean have these sort of issues, because oftentimes people right about the time that the kids are now gone, much kind of supportive on their own, right?
Pretty much.
You focus on your own retirement, and then you've got an aging parent oftentimes, or parents that you're...
I've been on conference calls about my parents. with my siblings. I mean, it's hard because it involves two things. One, it involves money, and it involves emotion and your relationship with your parents. And each one of your siblings has a different relationship with their parent than you do. It's true.
That's right.
You all grew up at the same place. Everyone is actually financially at a different place, and your relationship with your parents is at a different place.
I was third favorite.
Was that right? I was treated like a redheaded stepchild. I'm a redhead, so I can say that.
I was a stepchild.
Okay.
There you go. And as a young man, I thought my stepfather was a jerk, and the older I get, the more I love and respect the man.
He's a great guy.
Phenomenal guy. My mom picked really well.
Yes.
Yes.
He's a good guy.
Anyway, now we're going off topic.
All right.
This is Hanson McLean's Money Matters, in case you're wondering where you tuned in. Hanson McLean's Money Matters. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue with calls. We're also going to talk about what you should expect your advisor should do for you. So stick around for more of Hanson McLean's Money Matters.
Wondering if you're on track with your financial matters? Call now at 1-888-2-HANSON. That's 1-888-2-HANSON.
Welcome back to Hanson McLean's Money Matters. Scott Hanson.
Pat McLean.
To be part of our show again, 1-888-2-HANSON, 1-888-2-HANSON. And let's talk with Chris in Sacramento. Chris, you're with Hanson McLean.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Hi, Chris.
Hi. I'm recently retired. I retired the end of September 2016 from the Postal Service, and I went to one of your seminars, and I was pretty much on the right track anyway. I paid my house off the month that I retired.
Great. Good for you.
Great.
So I had that okay. I had no credit card debt. I have a car payment, but I could have paid off the car, but it was 0% interest, so I figured why not?
Didn't make any difference,
yep.
Yeah.
So I'm able to live okay on what I'm getting from the retirement and the Social Security. I don't have to dip into anything that I save in my TSP.
Wonderful.
And the TSP, I have $525,000.
Wow. Good for you. Yeah.
Now, they offered me an annuity of $2,600 a month, but I don't need it now, so I didn't take it.
Makes sense.
So now I know at age 70 and a half, you have to take a certain percentage out. Is that correct?
Yeah. How old are you?
67.
Okay.
So is your main question on this TSP and what happens when I'm 70 and a half and should I plan on something today?
Yes.
Okay. So at 70 and a half, it's about 3.5%.
So for you, it's about roughly $18,000 a year.
$18,000 a year?
Yeah. A little higher than that.
3.5%.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
$18,000 to $20,000 a year.
But if you don't take it between now and the time you reach 70 and a half, presumably the 525 is going to continue to grow.
Right.
So it could be more. Are you single or married?
Single.
Okay.
And what's your approximate income? What we're doing is we're trying to determine whether you should convert any of this to a Roth right now.
Yes.
Okay. What I'm getting from Social Security and retirement?
Yeah,
correct.
After deductions?
Before. Gross.
Oh, gross? That's $2,255 for Social Security and $1,771 for.
So $48,000 a year, approximately.
So the way our tax brackets work, they're graduated and progressive. So when our first dollars are essentially tax-free, and then we have some dollars, a good portion of dollars that are taxed at a 15% federal level, then at a certain point it jumps to 25%. So what Pat and I are thinking about right now is if you do nothing between now and age 70 and a half, when you hit 70 and a half, your required minimum distributions from your TSP are going to be such that some of that income will be subject to a 25% tax, where you could have had paid a tax at a lower rate if you took it out prior to that.
Of 15%.
And we're not talking about the whole thing, but there might be $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 of room today, depending on your other deductions, where you can convert some money to a Roth IRA essentially lock in that lower tax rate, because the Roth will be tax-free down the road.
So what happens with the Roth is you convert it. Right now, when you pull the money out, you pay taxes on it, and you can't put it back into another vehicle. But with a Roth IRA, you pull the money out, you pay taxes on it, and then it converts to a Roth IRA. The Roth IRA grows tax-free, grows tax-deferred, and comes out tax-free. So in your situation, financially, you're fine. Right, you're
totally,
you're complete. Yeah. You've done a great job. You should be very proud of yourself. I assume you were hardworking and very good conservative saver. And a great saver. So that isn't the worry. This is cleaning up around the edges, is right. What this is. And I would recommend that you actually look at converting, and you could do it with an advisor, and you'll convert some portion of it
by yourself if you're comfortable.
Yeah, if you're comfortable with that. If you're comfortable, how is the thrift save? And for the rest of the listeners, a thrift savings plan
401k
is a 401k, but it from the federal government. Yeah. How is it allocated?
That was another question I have. I'm way high in stocks. I've got 21% in the G fund, 9% in the F fund, 62% in the C fund, mm-hmm. and 8% in the S fund. So I've got 70%. In stock.
If this 525 fell to 400 next month, how would you react?
Yeah, what would you do?
obviously, you wouldn't like it. I understand that.
But what would
I would not like it. In 2008, I went back. That's why I have this question. I went back and looked, and I had lost in 2008. And I had, at that time, it was more like 53% in stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And I had $182,000 at that time. I lost $43,000.
Did you change your allocation?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, then you have
Yeah, several times. I went from, all G to went to 70% stocks.
So you only lose when you sell, right?
Chris,
you lock them in.
Chris, you need a financial advisor.
You will benefit from
you will benefit
whether it's
from
Hanson
that.
McClain or someone else.
And you'll look at it and you'll say, well, I don't want to pay for that. You need to pay for that. Because right now your allocation is too high in stocks based upon your previous. And it wouldn't, in the end of the day, you're not going to spend all this money anyway, right? A good advisor will actually encourage you to actually spend the money, to go on a trip, to go out to dinner. A good advisor will actually emotionally help you through that. A good advisor would make sure your allocation was correct going into the downturn in the market. And a good advisor would probably have stopped you from changing the allocation once the stock is down. So you need an advisor for
You'll
many
benefit
reasons.
From it.
For many reasons. You'll benefit from it. Your life will be easier.
Vanguard actually did a study that talked about a good financial advisor can yield up to 3 percentage points a year in excess returns. Some of that, about half of that, was attributed to planning issues like this Roth we just talked about. So about half it's planning issues. And about the other half is helping people have the proper allocations and sticking through those allocations over time.
So
Now, right, maybe you misunderstood me. I did not change those allocations once I lost all that money, if that's what you're talking about.
Oh, I thought you said you did.
I thought you said you did.
No, I had over the years changed it. Prior to this loss, I had changed it from the G fund to the 70% in stocks. And I left it at that after I lost that money.
Oh, well,
okay.
Forget that little.
Yeah. Avoid financial advisors.
Yeah, they're terrible. Keep that soapbox out of underneath me.
No, I did not.
No, you should, at a minimum, you should bring your allocation down to 50% equity.
At this point, Chris, you
can do anything you want.
Yeah.
Right? So you could have 100% equity.
I'm just worried about the downturn if I lost that much, because that was a... What was that? Is it like 40% or something that I lost?
So even if you're, let's say, half in stocks,
uh-huh.
if we have another downturn like before, you're going to still lose over 100,000 in this thing.
Right.
Yeah.
But you also need to think of what's the highest probability of good returns in the future. So we can either focus on quarter to quarter or year to year or the longer term.
Yeah,
and you've got the luxury because you don't necessarily need these dollars for current income.
Chris, at a minimum, you want to bring this down to 50%. And I still haven't changed my opinion that you need a financial advisor. We joke about it. But you're calling a talk show to get financial advice.
But I listen to you guys all the time.
It's a good talk show.
Seminar, so yeah. I, no.
Anyway.
Thanks, Chris.
Chris, thank you very much.
Wish you well.
Take care.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Congratulations. What a great job.
Yeah.
You've done a great job.
Yeah.
Truly. Truly.
And, you know, for the rest of the listeners, Chris got here by hard work and savings.
Yeah, consistency.
You don't get $500,000 in your 401k by accident.
You know what's funny?
And she's 67, so she didn't retire at 57.
What did she say in the downturn? Her account value was 180?
That's savings and time.
Yeah, savings and time.
All right, 1-888-2-HANSEN to join Hanson McLean. We're talking to Lucy. Lucy, you're with Hanson McLean.
Oh, good. Good afternoon or good morning, guys. Right. Thanks for taking my call.
I listen
to you guys all the time while I'm jogging.
So wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I'm 62 years old. I just turned 62 in April. I retired May 1st. And my basic question is I elected to start my Social Security in June. And I take a distribution from both my Roth IRA and my 401k. With the goal being to net the same monthly amount that I did when I was working, not in concert with my Social Security, which I'm doing. My question is, would I have been better off deferring taking Social Security and taking a larger distribution from either my Roth or my 401k?
And it's not too late.
What percentage are you withdrawing from those accounts?
Well, I have $185,000 in my 401k, and I'm taking $1,000 a month, which nets $909 with the tax.
Okay.
And then I'm taking $1,000 a month from my Roth, which the balance on that is about $39,000. Social Security, my gross was $1,474 a month. I've elected to take 10% tax out, so that nets me $1,323. So that's about what I was netting when I was working.
Yeah. Your distributions from your 401k and IRA are way too large, and they are not sustainable over a long period of time.
Okay.
That's the reality.
It's over 10%.
Yeah, you're well over 10%. So when you add the $2, the $24,000 a year you're taking out, and your account balance is approximately $225,000, you're well over 10%, which is not sustainable over a period of time. So the answer to the question is, should I or shouldn't I have taken the Social Security? I still don't know the answer to that. I suspect that you would had no choice but to do that. But you really need to sit down and look at what you're spending.
Is your home paid for?
Oh, no. I'm about $15,000 in negative equity.
What you mean, what's the value of the home?
You want an honest answer from us?
Yes.
You shouldn't have retired.
I plan to actually go back to work part-time in the fall.
Yeah. All right. So what's the value of the home?
The home is approximately $270,000, and I owe about $285,000.
And where do you live in what part of the United States?
Sacramento.
And how long have you owned the home?
For 13 years.
Okay. Yeah, you need to probably go back to work and suspend Social Security and let it grow until age 70.
Okay. Can you suspend it then?
You can suspend it at any time.
Oh, you can. Okay, well, that's good to know.
Yeah, yeah. And you probably need to go back more than halftime.
Okay.
Our concern, and it's not that you can't make it happen for now. Our concern is not this next decade. Our concern is when Lucy's older and can no longer go out and run.
80.
And,
you know. I mean, you're running now. I mean, I hope you can run when you're 90.
Me too. Okay, well, I mean, I appreciate this, so this helps me.
All right, Lucy.
Yeah, yeah. So,
wish you well.
All right.
Sorry to be the bearers of the bad news.
You.
Yeah, wish you well. But running at 62, I spoke to my father this morning, who's 79, and he's gotten seriously back into running again. He was telling me down in Manhattan Beach, he goes up and down these hills, like a whole workout. Up and one, down the next. Up
79.
One, down the next. He says, yeah, there's like 40 of them. He said, I think I did like 30. I used to be able to do 40, but I still did.
He's slowing down.
Like,
come on, Tom. You're slowing down.
Oh, my goodness. Anyway.
How many miles is it? Do you know?
He said he ran 10 miles the other day.
That's incredible.
I don't understand it. But anyway, if you want to join the program, 1-888-2-HANSON. Again, 1-888-2-HANSON. And let's talk with Raj. Raj, you're with Hanson McLean.
Hi, Scott. Hi, Pat. How are you this morning?
Wonderful. How are you doing, Raj?
I had a question about long-term care. I'm 48 years old, and I'm just the past couple of years just looking into them. I know there's been a perfect storm between the interest rates and the claims with baby boomers going forward.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been looking at the partnership long-term care, also long-term care insurance, and also the CalPERS long-term care. I have a sibling that works for the state. So I can get CalPERS long-term care.
Is that right?
Isn't that hilarious?
Is that right?
A sibling.
Yeah.
You got to love the state of California. The highest tax incomes. All they keep doing is raising taxes.
Oh, my gosh. That's just crazy.
Oh, you work for the state? Not only do you have benefits, but you have any siblings? Or siblings get
a neighbor?
Close friend?
I think actually... Yeah, your father-in-law, your mother-in-law, that they have a whole string of people that qualify.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so what's your question
for? I'm sure it doesn't cost the taxpayers a dime, Pat. I wouldn't worry about that.
As I'm Googling houses for sale in Nevada. I wonder if my wife would like living in this state.
If Elon Musk could get that Hyperloop between Nevada and California.
Yeah, we'd be done.
Yeah.
So what's your question for us?
Excellent. Looking at those three, I'm not sure which one would be more beneficial. I know that the sweet spot to get the insurance would be between ages 50 and 55.
So here's how we view long-term care insurance, okay? If you look at most long-term care expenditures, they're for a shorter period of time. The average male is about a year. The average female is about 2 years.
That's average.
These are average. Now, if you do you plan for your retirement well, you could afford on your last year to be in a long-term care facility, or the last 2 years, maybe the last 3 years. Where it's devastating is where it's a multiple-year stay, right? Where there's maybe early onset Alzheimer's or something where, and those are the outliers, but that's where you need the insurance, right? Think of it like, it's the major issues in life that we need insurance, not for the minor things. So
sure.
We think the best way to view long-term care is if you could have an extremely long waiting period. Some company had a 2 year wait period.
2 years.
And then a lifetime payment. Because a lot of policies are sold where it's maybe a 90-day waiting period, but it's capped at a couple years' worth of payments. And when you're thinking, well, I'm only buying a couple hundred thousand dollars worth of insurance. I could afford the couple hundred thousand dollars insurance. I'm worried about the $2 million claim.
And the longer the waiting period, think about it as like the...
auto insurance.
Auto insurance. It's the deductible.
I have a $5,000 deductible on my auto. And the reason I do is because I know one thing. I get an fender bender.
You're not going to submit the claim.
Because the rates go up.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to submit a claim unless it's a large.
So that's the first thing to look at. The second thing to look at is obviously, how secure is the company that you're buying it from? And the pool of which you get to choose is relatively small compared to 15 years ago. There's just not that many players in the industry anymore. My guess is you're going to land on the one that allows you to buy it through the state. That would be my guess.
Yeah.
Is that the way you're leaning?
Right. That's the way I'm leaning, but I need to get more information from them. I know I can mail away for a brochure to get more information. I did go on that areyoureadyca.gov for their long-term care information that they have on their website. But I'm still just not certain whether...
What's your income like?
I'm making about $220 a year.
What do you have in savings investments?
In my 401k, I have about $560. In my brokerage accounts, I have about $100.
Okay. $100K. And will you have a pension at retirement?
I will, but I'm not confident. I'm assuming there might be a freeze or a hard freeze.
Right, so it's not going to be 48. So, yeah, you're probably
makes sense.
I don't you're probably a good candidate to buy long-term care insurance.
Yeah. All righty.
Okay, great.
All right, Roger.
All right,
the call.
You guys.
Yeah, wish you luck. So, Pat, I'll tell you a story. So, a few months ago, a friend said, hey, would you mind meeting with a friend of mine who's looking at a career change? So, I met with this man. He was, mid-30s or something like that. And he was a wholesaler in long-term care insurance. Okay, so his job was to talk to other people who sold long-term care insurance, and he was kind of getting tired of the grind, and he was thinking about becoming a financial advisor. So this person asked if he could meet with me to talk about what it would mean to be a financial advisor. And so as I'm meeting with him, I said, look, you've got 15 years of specialty in this industry. Why don't you – there's a great need out there. Most financial planners –
don't understand long.
Not well enough. They know enough to be dangerous. Not to really, just like this last call.
We
said, yes.
We said we didn't know.
We're not experts in long-term care. So why don't you, I said, there's clearly a need for some expertise in this area. And he had mentioned there's someone that he knew that did hourly billing long-term care planning. Just like you would hire an accountant.
Someone would pay you.
And I said, that's really interesting. Anyway, my advice to him was, I said, I wouldn't try to go into the financial planning business. It's going to take you years to build up a clientele. You've already got this 15 years of expertise. There's clearly a need in the marketplace. I'd find a way to be a specialist in this area. And I said, if there's a business model out there that's working with some sort of you can charge someone a flat fee for analysis and recommendation. I said, I think there's a market for it.
Copy the business model.
Yeah, or improve upon it. There are a lot of people who bought policies years ago.
And thought that premiums would never go up.
And they kept going up and up and up and up.
So I tell you, we had, Pat, at the beginning of the program, we said we were going to talk about what you should expect your financial advisor to do for you.
Yeah, what is a financial advisor? What sort of services should you get from a financial advisor? The term
actually
is used loosely.
Even thinking back of the callers we had on the program today, even just reminded me even more. So the term is used loosely.
Yes.
So almost anyone can call themselves a financial advisor. It's not like if you're a medical doctor, you have to have a medical degree and be approved or whatever before you can say, I'm a medical doctor.
That is correct. You cannot hold yourself out as an MD.
Although you might be able to call yourself a health specialist.
Yes.
Whatever that
means.
So anyway, financial advisor can mean lots of things. So if you're paying for financial advice,
what should you be receiving?
Correct. That's probably the best way to look at it, right? And part of it, just part of it, is the investment management.
An important part of it, but not all of it. Your financial advisor should be concerned as much about your debt. Should be much concerned about how these dollars are going to pass from you to
whomever
in your estate. Should be concerned about your taxes. Right?
In a huge way. I mean, earlier in the program, we talked about someone doing a Roth conversion on a portion of a 401k plan because they're in their mid-60s.
But that was not why she called.
That's
correct.
She
wanted to know what her taxes would look like 3 years from now. But that's what a financial advisor does. The financial advisor asks questions and then makes recommendations that are specific to your situation, that are in your best interest and are not always product-led. They aren't solved with a big old fat annuity or variable life insurance policy or you name the flavor of the day investment. Financial advice is exactly that, which is advice that is particular to your situation after an advisor understands your situation. It's highly emotional in many situations because it's you and your money. And it most certainly would require some research, some questions.
You know, Pat, it's interesting. There's been this rise of what are called robo-advisors.
Yes.
And you see some of them advertising on TV. And they call themselves advisors. But it really all it is an asset allocation tool. It's an investment management tool. There's no real advice there.
Yeah, they're taking your money and saying you should invest it X, Y, and Z.
And they call themselves advisors, and I've always kind of scratched my head. I'm like,
Where's the advice?
That's not advice. It's investment management.
Correct.
Robo investment management.
Get why they call it robo advisors.
Well, they want to take the business from financial advisors. I understand that.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah. I get the marketing shtick associated with it.
But if you've got if you're paying for somebody to help you with your investments, you should expect a lot more than just investment management. And the reason you should is because there's plenty of great certified financial planners, other chartered financial consultants, other professionals out there that will give you a whole lot more.
For the same price or less.
Than just investment management. And things such as even helping you determine what the dollars are for. Oftentimes people will save their whole life because they were told since the beginning of time, you need to save. They saved. Now they're retired and they're saving.
Yes.
For what?
Correct. I can absolutely relate to that. But it's a behavior that you've got to walk a person through to say it's okay to now start enjoying spending. Some people, their joy comes from saving. But so that's what a financial advisor does, is works with you as an individual.
And
or
your
as a
financial
family.
Advisor should be looking at not just your investment. They should be looking at your tax situation, determining if that's the right thing, talking about areas of insurance, estate planning, et cetera. And if your advisor never talks about those things or has any conversations with them, then maybe you've got the wrong advisor set up.
Yeah. So, and essentially what is on our website at HansenMcLean.com, which is we call the 7 personal decision points.
Yeah. And last week, boy, we had great attendance in the Bay Area and in Denver for our workshop on Social Security and integrating Social Security with the rest of your financial life. I mean,
yeah, some of the best numbers we've seen.
Yeah. Demand's been huge. And this coming week, we've got them in Sacramento. So if you're outside of the Sacramento area, we apologize. But this coming week, Wednesday in Sacramento, Thursday in Granite Bay, Saturday in Ranch Cordova. Go to HansenMcLean.com.
And this is to find out how your Social Security benefits work and how to get as much out of them as you possibly can.
Yeah, how they integrate with everything else. So, again, go to HansenMcLean.com for more information and to register, and we'll see you this week. Anyway, we are out of time. We come to you every Saturday at this same time, this same station. You can also get a podcast of it. If you aren't a podcast subscriber yet, we suggest you subscribe. I think you'll find it worth your while. And anyway, enjoy the rest of your weekend. This has been Hanson McLean's Money Matters.
This program has been brought to you by Hanson McLean Advisors, a registered investment advisory firm. Any ideas presented during this program are not intended to provide specific financial advice, and you should consult your own financial advisor, tax consultant, or estate planning attorney to conduct your own due diligence.